This is Stories of Win, where we showcase amazing women in neuroscience. We chat with them about their research, their unique journeys through academia, and what drives their passion for studying the brain. Here is one of their stories.
My name is Nancy Padilla with Stories of Win, and I have the pleasure today of interviewing Dr. Carmen Maldonado Vlad, who's the professor in neuroscience in the Department of Biology and the director of undergraduate research office at the University of Puerto Rico, Río Piedras campus. Thank you so much for letting me interview you today.
Thank you, Nancy. A pleasure to see you again.
So we always like starting asking the women we interview, how did you first become interested in the brain?
Okay. Well, that was a while ago now.
Doesn't matter.
But actually, I think it was in high school, I was really intrigued by trying to understand the biological basis of behavior. So for me, it was always questionable why people behave this way. I mean, what is the origin of these behaviors that sometimes for me were really fascinating, but sometimes were really scary. So with that in mind, then I was always questioning the role of the nervous system, because of course we knew at the for me through my science courses that the brain sat as an epicenter of behavior, right? And so, but I wanted to search further, or what was the role? How was it making behavior? Because it's always been my interest to we study the behavioral neuroscience, right? It was always something that really intrigued me. And so when I was accepted at the university here, at the University of Puerto Rico, Río Piedras campus, I entered through biology, searching for that question, but I also knew that understanding behavior, I needed to understand all the other aspects that can, regulate behavior, which is your environment, your social setting as an individual in a society. So therefore, and also psychology, what was the aspect of the cognitive process for us to understand behavior. And so that's why I said, okay, if I want to continue biology, but I also need to take courses in psychology. So that's why I did both majors in biology and psychology.
Mm-hmm. And what was your first encounter with a research experience as an undergrad?
Well, that was on my junior year here. And I had the opportunity to do undergraduate research in the School of Medicine here at the University of Puerto Rico Medical Sciences campus. There I went into the Department of Pharmacology, and I worked with Dr. Jose Gilberto Ortiz, who still is professor at the department 30 years ago. And Dr. Ortiz at the time was very much interested in understanding the role of GABA in seizures, and how seizure activity impacted learning and memory, and using an animal model of in mice, of audiogenic seizure phenomenon in mice. And so that was my introduction to, bench work, to work with animals in neuroscience. The first thing I worked with mice was it. And that was a very interesting experience for me, because in the past I had, I did do some, research at the high school level, but I wasn't.
That's really impressive.
Yeah. I was in all these science fairs that we have, ferias científicas, like we call them here. I won awards and that because.
Wow. Yeah. So you had an knack for science since high school.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I was always a very inquisitive individual, and I always enjoyed being in science courses. I was since elementary school. In fact, my science teacher at the time, through basically third, fourth grade, I still remember his name, Señor Curbelo, and I was his pet. I was always with him, checking out what he was doing. He used to call me Sara, because my name is Carmen Sara, and so he would call me, Sara, what are you doing? And it was just so fascinating of what was going on. And I was like, wow, this is so cool. This is wonderful.
So you dreamed to become a scientist since you were little?
I think so, but, you know, when you don't get... The references for being a scientist, a natural scientist, were missing in my family, because both my parents were social scientists. They came from social sciences. My father was a political science professor, and my mom, her background is in social work and in sociology. So that was my reference, mm-hmm. right? But never. As I thought that I could be doing more like bench work, mm-hmm. or because I did not have the experience. So, but in my science courses as a child and later as an adolescent, these science teachers were my mentors. And I think that's where I really found the modeling of what is a good mentor? What mm-hmm. is it that you have to do to entice students to really love mm-hmm. The discipline that you choose to mm-hmm. study, right? But my science teachers were just amazing. And I think they were really the basis for me to develop, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I came to college, My teachers were like, oh, yes, you should go through, you know, but then they would say, and then continue medical school.
Oh, really? They said
yes.
That?
And I went like, okay, well, it's because they didn't entice or didn't give me the background or the encouragement to look at other opportunities that were through science at the time. Which for me was contradictory, because they were all of them were great scientists, but they did not say you should continue
a PhD.
Yeah. So at the time the counselor at school also was very much applied kind of thing. So you should continue into medical school or that type of thing. So those were mm-hmm. my background then. So I entered here in the biology department, in fact, where I ended up being professor at the years later, thinking that was what I was going to do. In fact, I said I was going to be a pediatrician. But still, I was really interested in understanding the brain, and so I thought, well, a pediatrician, but maybe a neurologist or something. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, mm-hmm. it was, you know, shuffling many ideas at the time. But the crucial thing that made me change was the undergraduate research experience, and in a neuroscience mm-hmm. lab, and understanding how the brain worked in a disease setting, obviously, meaning discussing, you know, what is epilepsy and seizures and things that occur in the brain. And so those 2 years were really crucial. And it also helped me understand what is the dynamics of working in a lab with graduate students, undergraduates, your PI, scheduling. It was really enriching experience. And I think in fact, it was my first two publications came as an undergraduate.
Two publications. Mm-hmm. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I was co-author, of course, but it really showed that first that Dr. Ortiz saw very much the value of what I was doing and my enthusiasm, but also it gave me an idea of what meant to write a mm-hmm. paper. It gave me feelings of belonging to this environment. And so I think that was also very instrumental in the way I then carved my way up to where I am now.
So where did you do your PhD?
So I did my PhD at Northeastern University in Boston. Northeastern is a university that it had a, well, it still does, a psychology department. And so I first went, before I go into graduate school, I took a gap year, what you now call a gap year. But it was a year where I wanted to really have an experience to work in the field of neuroscience. And so I went first before Northeastern. I got a job in the university, in Boston University Medical School, which is in Boston. And the reason why I was in Boston and I chose to go there, it was because I really wanted to, you know, have an experience outside Puerto Rico. I had a friend that she was living in Boston, Puerto Rican. And she said, why don't you, you know, come? And so I did. And it was my first time because I had done exchange for a year.
Like internships?
Yeah, I did an internship at University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And that was my junior year. I did the junior year there. But then I came back to Puerto Rico and then I continued the work I was doing. But I like Massachusetts, so that's why I returned. And then that year I worked as a technician in the laboratory of Dr. Janina Galler, who is part of, she's an MD PhD that studies nutrition and behavior, not only in the clinical setting, but also she had an animal model on nutrition. And that's when I experienced working with rats. And I did all the learning and memory experiments of food deprivation and how it impacts the brain development and then how that impacts, learning. So that was another moment for me to really get interested again in behavioral neuroscience.
So then you were a research tech in Boston and from there you stayed for your PhD.
And then I knew that I wanted to continue graduate studies after my bachelor degree. But I, like I said, I wanted a break because I was, did a double major 5 years. And so I said, okay, I just want to get more experience. And then I went around in Boston, of course, there's several institutions. So I went to different institutions that had something in behavioral neuroscience. I remember going to Harvard to see what they had in the psychology department. I still remember they have this tower where they are located. And so
is it like brochures? Like, you know, like to pick up brochures or something?
Yeah,
this is obviously
I just wanted to imagine, tú sabes. You're by yourself. This is, I'm what, 22, you know, and I'm just looking for information.
And so, there's no department websites back then,
no,
right?
No, there was nothing like that. So then I had to go in person, of course, and go to the office and talk to the secretary. And then the secretary got me to talk to the chair at the time, who was a very famous psychologist that I've read about his work and stuff. And then I said, he interviewed me, you know, because I said, I want to know because he's so naive, you know, you go there and these things. And so he said, well, Carmen, you know, what you want, we don't have here because we're more experimental. Well, B.F. Skinner was at Harvard, right? So, and I'm like, really? You don't have anything for me here? He said, no, we don't have it. I see. We don't really have the people that could work with you here. And I said, okay, but you can apply. He said, you can apply, but really not. Okay, well, which was surprising to me. And later on, I understood many other things. So I said, okay, but I'm going to apply anyway, right? I took the GRE, I took all this stuff. And then that's when I got a phone call from who would be later my mentor for my master's at Northeastern University, who at the time he was the chair of the psychology department at Northeastern. And he called me because he saw my application. And he called me and said, Carmen, we want you to come to Northeastern. Let me show you around. See the difference?
Very different attitude, yeah.
And so I was like, wow, they're actually recruiting me. You see, the other one said, no, we don't have anything for you here, which I, till this day.
Hard to believe, right? Yeah.
Till this day. I tell this story to my students. And then now this guy wants, he's recruiting me, and then I went to see him and he showed me around. And indeed, at that time, Northeastern had a very, because he was chair, Dr. James Teller, and Jim was into recruiting new faculty in the field of behavioral neuroscience. And so I was...
It was growing.
It was growing. And that was a moment when he was really committing to increasing diversity into his student population. So I have to tell you, I was the first Latina.
This is the...
In 1990s.
Okay. Yeah.
Early 1990s. And I was the first Puerto Rican Latina to be accepted at the graduate program. And there was just another African, another African-American woman.
So no other Latin students?
No, I was the only Latina at the time. And then the other were a couple of African-American students, and the rest was, you know, mostly majority white. And there were students from Canada, I think. But that was it. That was the time that I was in graduate school. And so there was a lot to deal with, okay? Mm-hmm. Especially in Boston, which at the time was a very it was a challenge from the standpoint of inclusivity and diversity. Mm-hmm. And so these were issues that I had to deal with through that. But I guess I survived all the harassment and the discrimination. Not at the level of the university. It was more at the social level and walking on the streets, going to stores and people following you because they think you're going to steal something.
Wow.
Like that. So those were the times.
So really being targeted, like, because you didn't look like the others.
No. So those were issues that people, when they are the only ones, or they represent some group, social group, whichever it is, we face a lot of challenges from that standpoint of integration, assimilation, belongingness. You know, depends on how welcoming the group is. You will feel that, you know, you're part of this. I was fortunate to, I have to say, that the professors and my peers were so chévere, you know, very endearing, very, you know, really cared about us. Mm-hmm. And so that really made the difference, because outside it was quite hostile environment for us, people of color in Boston in the 90s, or at least where I hang out, which is basically, you know, downtown Boston. And so, but those were those years. I hope things are better. But it's a very polarized city. You know, the Hispanics live here, the Black live here, the other, you know, communities live in the very, very in silos, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not so much integration. Mm-hmm. And so I just happened to be like this a fly in a glass of milk, you know. It was just this thing that is there, and you know, what
visible
to do with this.
Yeah.
But I was able to navigate, but it really taught me a lot about the issues that people of color face in the United States at different levels, in academic levels and in also other social settings. And so I am very, sensitive about those issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now switching to the science,
yes.
Like tell us about your doctoral research and what type of discoveries did you make through your PhD?
Yeah. Well, when I started at Northeastern, like I said, in the PhD, and I first did my master's was using an animal model of reward that is called intracranial self-stimulation. In this model, which, because I was, you know, both, that was under Dr. Jim Steller, who is an expert on this, on the field of brain stimulation. And then our project was to see the role of what cocaine, or an analog of cocaine in this case. We had GBR, I forget the numbers, GBR 102, 3, I think, and cocaine. We gave animals both these two substances during their self-stimulation process. And what we wanted to see is how much these drugs were enhancing or diminishing the reward process of these animals, no? Through examining how much they would self-stimulate through ICESS. Something that you and I would know already to say, sure, of course, I mean, we know what will happen. Well, at the time, no one had done the experiment.
Wow, that's so cool. Those are the foundational experiments.
Yeah, so we were the first ones to do that work. And that we got published. I remember I did that work with an undergraduate student that was, basically, I was her mentor, Susan Melnick. And then with that, after that project, Jim was able to recruit who would be later my PhD mentor was Dr. Ann Kelly. And Dr. Kelly was a leader in the field of understanding a lot to do with the role of the nucleus accumbens on appetitive behavior. And was seminal in understanding the role of what in the past we will call the PAPES circuit and how the mesolimbic system regulates reward and reinforcement. And so when I started working with Anne, I was fascinated by her research at the time and also her broad knowledge in neuroanatomy, in behavior, in pharmacology. She was a student of Sue Iverson, who was one of the leaders in the field of psychopharmacology, understanding what serotonin, norepinephrine, and all these classical neurotransmitters do to the brain when she was in England and later in France. And so with Anne, I learned to do microinjections straight into the brain. To do minor surgeries in rats. And what we were able to discover was that the nucleus accumbens, the neuroanatomist had separated the core and the shell of the nucleus accumbens for many years. That was seminal work that happened in the Netherlands and also in the United States. And what we embarked was to see if groups of cells that behave, that basically look different between the core and the shell, and the projections from the core were more motoric in nature versus the shell was more limbic in nature. So my question was, okay, can we typify this behaviorally speaking? And so we did. And so what we were the first that discovered that you could have the core and the shell have completely different behavioral profiles. And that paper changed many things because that's when everybody say, so when we want to look at, if you want to look at behaviors that are more emotionally motivational processes, then your brain injection should be in the shell. But if you want to see more motoric processes more, then it should be in the core.
Were you silencing the core or the
yes,
shell?
Yes, we did microlesions first.
Oh, lesioning, okay.
We did microlesionings first, and that was also a first. That was the first time we could set, because lesioning the core and then separately lesioning the shell was really challenging at that time.
They're very close, yeah.
Yeah, and they were not electrolytic, they were chemical lesions, okay? So that, you know, with the injections, when you do infusions, you have to be very precise. Then you have to do a lot of histology. You have to make sure, prove that you were only in the core and only in the shell. And then look at behavior, make sure that the animals, you know.
By any chance, is this your paper that's in Journal of Neuroscience?
No, this was in psychopharmacology. But the paper in Journal of Neuroscience was more later when we worked on the role of the GABAergic system into controlling feeding from the hypothalamus and also glutamate. So that was another thing of separating the core and the shell.
Okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So those were my focus on my thesis were more to characterize that behavioral differentiation between the core and the shell. And then that gave a lot of information for everybody that was looking at the accumbens now that the accumbens cannot be seen just as as a nuclei. But then later came the rostral shell and the caudal shell and all these other more specific topography of how the structures are organized and how, depending on where you tap on, then you will have different behaviors.
Right.
So those were our contributions at the doctoral level.
Amazing. Those are like very seminal and important contributions that we take for granted now. Like, it's like, of course they're different. It's like, actually, there's a lot of evidence, your doctoral work behind that. Mm-hmm. And so when you finish your PhD, I actually don't know, did you do a postdoc? Like,
yes, I did. I follow my postdoctoral work after I felt that with Anne, I had a very strong background in the molecular and cellular underpinnings of reward. Then I really wanted to learn to do self-administration because that was another model, animal model, that of course is like a standard for understanding drug-seeking behavior and addiction in general. And since I had intracranial self-stimulation, which is another model of reward, then I said, I think I want to learn another technique, which is the cocaine self-administration, particularly because I had experience with cocaine in the past in the animal model. And so I knew of Dr. George Koob's lab that was at the Department of Neuropharmacology at the Scripps Research Institute in San Diego, which is next to the Salk where you were many years before. And so I did apply, and coming from Ann Kelly's lab was really a very wonderful letter of recommendation. And so Dr. Koob hired me to be one of his 30 postdocs.
30?
Yes.
Wow.
That he had there. It was way too many. But he had a lot. And so I became part of this big group of people.
Wow, that's like an institute.
Yeah, it's pretty big. His lab was pretty big at the time. Now right now he is the director of the National Institute of Alcohol and Alcoholism.
Oh, yeah, I've seen him in talks, I think.
Yeah, so he was my postdoctoral mentor. And then I was assigned to one of his collaborators, which was Bert Weiss, who... his background is in neurochemistry, but he's also he done some behavioral pharmacology through the using self-administration models. When I was there, one of my postdocs at that lab was Dr. Larry Parsons, who passed away unfortunately too early. And Larry and I were the two postdocs at that time there. And so he was doing more electrochemistry and neurochemistry using microdialysis, which is some technique that it was used a lot in order to understand what was being released at the time. And voltammetry and all this stuff that now, you know, things have evolved. But he used to do a lot of microdialysis, and then I focused on creating what now we call cocaine seeking behavior paradigms. And what, again, my hat of a behavioral neuroscientist, I came to Bert Weiss to say, you know, we should be trying to create a model of seeking behavior where the animal, you would have the animal lever press for cocaine, but also associate cues affiliated to, you know, the environment. And then have them, but then these are the environment has to be a visual and auditory cue. So more complex. So, and then you will have them train, associate, which is classical conditioning. Very Pavlovian. The self-administration model requires the animal to learn to lever press. So, which is asking a very stimulus response kind of behavior in psychology, of course, and schedules of reinforcements are used and FR1, FR2, FR3. So these animals were trained to lever press, but every time they receive a cocaine infusion, they will be associated with an environment, right? A cue of the light and also a sound. Later I said, okay, now let's extinguish the behavior. And so the animals will go, enter, and then whatever, even if they would lever press, nothing happened. And then after that, I would re-expose them to the cues only. No cocaine on board. And we're talking that what this training made the animals, it really took a while to extinguish. I could have animals lever pressing for a month and a half without any cocaine. So then, but the amazing thing was that once I put them back to the same environment, the light and the cue, the light and the auditory cue, the animals started pressing like they had cocaine on board. So that was the paradigm, which is environmental elicited cocaine seeking behavior. And that paradigm, I developed it under Dr. Weiss.
So it's the idea that the cues, because they've associated these multiple cues to the cocaine, experiencing those cues is sufficient to like induce craving or
exactly.
something like
and that. Exactly, and that maintains a behavior. And this behavior, I could keep it at least for 7 days. And this is very important because, as you know, these animal models have they're supposed to create a homology with what would be what the human will have in a clinical setting, no, or in an experience. So what I say when we were envisioning this design was like, okay, imagine someone that is trying to detox, right? They take him to a clinic, you detox them pharmacologically, of course, you take all the drug out, metaphorically speaking, and then what do you do? You say, okay, bye, see you later. And then where do they go back? To the same environment that they previously associated with drugs. So the chances that they will reinstate, which is the reinstatement, seeking behavior. And then that is the most troubling problem for maintaining, someone out of using drugs. And so we wanted to create the same thing and then have enough space pharmacologically, design speaking, to have many days for us to manipulate pharmacologically so we could have drugs eventually to be potential for that period of time where these people are very vulnerable for drug seeking. And that was the contribution of this model, and that got published also at PINS. And it was very influential at the time.
Yeah, many people still use a paradigm just like that.
So it was called the Weiss model.
But it was really the Carmen model.
Yes, it was the Carmen model, but that how the cookie crumbles in this.
Yes.
So at the time I was like, okay, I am there. I'm the author, so, but it was hard at the beginning not to get the recognition, but I know I did that job. Everybody knew that who did that project was Carmen, and that's how it is. I presented the data in many scientific forums. So
did it influence your lab's research?
Yes, because that I used that model for many of my studies with, I established the first cocaine self-administration lab here in Puerto Rico. I was the only one for many years. Now Dr. Carlos Jimenez has self-administration model there in his lab here at the medical school.
How many years have you had your lab at the University of Puerto Rico?
I started in 97, so almost 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah, well, now we'll be 27 or 28 years old. 28, yeah.
You have to celebrate.
Yeah.
The 30 years of the lab.
Still, I have to wait a little bit for that. But yes, I really enjoy the doing science. It's just so rewarding for me. I mean, at least that's how I feel when I go into the lab. This is a passion thing. It's not, you know,
clock out.
No, it's not.
It's too hard to be clock out.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, I loved it so much. And it's very, it just engages you in so many moments for you to be creative, mm-hmm. for you to contribute to an understanding in science that need to be addressed. It allows you to, inspire others, students, many
You've
students.
You've mentored hundreds of students.
Yeah, through the years I have many. In fact, I am very proud to say that almost 70% of my students are women. And so I have been very much committed into developing a path for future women neuroscientists in Puerto Rico, because, such as yourself, because I just feel that there's so much that we have to create scenarios of opportunities. That's mm-hmm. It really is about opportunity, Nancy.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know, then you won't seek. You won't, you know, you say, oh, if I knew that. You know, sometimes you get into, oh, I should have known this. But I think that's one of my goals, is that giving opportunities, telling students of all the things that are out there, and also praising their value, praising their capacities they have to achieve their goals, and also guiding them to say, you know, sometimes you say, okay, that path that you have decided, maybe we should look at this other, and just give feedback and also be very sensitive to what they really want to do. I mean, or they don't know what to do. So I think those my lab was, I was fortunate and privileged to be able to train students in the field of neuroscience in Puerto Rico, enjoy every time they go and present their posters and see them so happy and see that they could convey science to others when they go to SFN. They just love it, you know?
So actually, I didn't know this, but I'm at the University of Florida, for listeners that don't know. And one of my colleagues, who's a close friend, a few doors down, Paola Justi Rodriguez, she's an assistant professor there. And her first research experience was in your lab.
Yes.
So
yes.
That's an example of, like, you created opportunities for these now, like, Puerto Rican professor at the University of Puerto Rico, women in science. So that's just one example of someone that I just thought of, like, oh, right. First research experience was in your lab. So that's the influence. So, and beyond the mentoring, I guess, like, you know, there's probably so many projects in the history of your lab, but maybe a couple that you're very proud of, even whether they're old or current, and then maybe what excites you in the next decade of your lab, or, you know, in the future.
Sure. Well, I've been very much interested in continuing my quest of understanding the role of the nucleus accumbens at different aspects of reward behavior. So we did a lot of work on understanding the interactions, the neurochemical interactions that were occurring within the accumbens and how that relate to behavior. In particular, the role of glutamatergic interventions coming from hippocampus, the cortex, to the accumbens, to shell. And that we did a whole slew of studies understanding how NMDA receptors, metabotropic glutamate receptors within the nucleus accumbens play a major role in cocaine reward. We did a lot of those studies that are already that connection between glutamate and dopamine within the accumbens and how that relates to cocaine seeking behavior. That we did. We also went, my first graduate student, I was Lily Alvarez, who is working in one of these biotech companies. And she was more interested in the cellular molecular aspect of the glutamatergic system and how that relates to appetitive behavior and also a regular exploratory behavior as well within the accumbens. And so I was able to study further the structure that was so dear in my heart through my PhD. But later, I began very interested in oxytocin.
Oh, oxytocin.
Which we, as you know, of course, that you study, you know, social behavior that requires this very important neurohormone. So oxytocin and vasopressin, in fact, those two neurohormones I decided to investigate related to cocaine addiction. And so we did a whole slew of studies that found that oxytocin has anxiolytic properties in the setting of reward scenarios. And so what we see is that it takes out the edge. Oxytocin, if given intranasally or intracranially, would take the craving and the anxiety related to cocaine use, which is very interesting as well, and it has therapeutic potential.
Right. Yeah.
So that study brought me a collaboration with clinicians at the VA hospital here in San Juan, where they wanted to see if we could give intranasal oxytocin to patients that were suffering or they were having some substance abuse disorder, and seeing how if you give oxytocin will keep the edge of the anxiety that will make them crave. We did submit a grant for that, but we didn't get funded. But it made me an opportunity to see how from the bench you can go to bedside.
Yeah.
And it was really fun because it was a multidisciplinary committee group that we wanted to do this project. It was a very interesting and experience to work with clinicians, me working with rats, right? So it was really fun. So that I remember well. And I really enjoy, especially because the research division chair, the director, Doctora Molina, who is at the VA hospital, and she's more into imaging physician. She's a medicine. How you call this?
Physical medicine or
nuclear medicine?
Nuclear medicine. Okay,
nuclear medicine. She's a nuclear medicine background, and she does all this imaging work that is beautiful. That she works there, and so that was really nice. But recently, we found this is very cute, very interesting. Looking at oxytocin, my question was, okay, oxytocin and anxiolytic, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we've shown it many times in our papers, but why is it anxiolytic? What is it doing it doing in the brain?
Right, because it's intranasal, so it could go anywhere.
It goes everywhere.
Yeah.
But at the mechanistic level, who is it interacting that makes it anxiolytic?
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? The endocannabinoid system.
Very cool.
So oxytocin receptors are co-localized with CB1 receptors in where? The nucleus accumbens. And so imagine, full circle again. And I'm like, what? Totally into endocannabinoid system and oxytocin. And now we're all already looking at CB1 receptors, oxytocin, anxiety, depression. I've got into models of depression with our students. So I'm no longer doing cocaine work. I decided to change gears and look at other psychiatric disorders. And it's been wonderful. And I think it's completely understudied, the endocannabinoid system, from many perspectives that could have, because we all talk about, of course, the endocannabinoid system is where cannabis work, obviously.
And people talk about cannabis being anxiolytic, so.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, but self-administration.
They are as well. And so there's all this controversy about, well, you know, cannabis has, it's not addictive and stuff like that. Well, depends on the cannabis. Because if we're talking about cannabis sativa, which where a lot of THC is found, it has substance use disorder related to cannabis use disorder. It's such a thing. This exists. But then if you, most of these medicinal cannabis available are not sativa, are indica, which is another species of cannabis. And that doesn't have
as much THC.
No, it has CBD, which is a different kind of cannabis that has the way pharmacologically acts on CB1 receptors and CB2 receptors, of course, which are the receptors for endocannabinoid system. It doesn't elicit a rewarding experience like THC does. And so, see, but the problem, the greatest challenge for understanding really how cannabis can be a potential really for treating substance use disorders or others is that we need to change the level of at the law that cannabis is now Schedule 1 in the federal law for drugs of abuse. And what
is that, the highest schedule?
The highest, right next to LSD, right next to the NMDA, which is ecstasy. They're all Schedule 1. And so those are supposedly by the federal law. That's why when you have cannabis, medical cannabis being authorized, it's at the state level, but not at the federal level. Mm-hmm. It's still illegal at the federal level to traffic cannabis or do this. As long as it happens in the state, it's okay. So once Congress changes the law, the federal law, that allows marijuana to become Schedule 3.
Like alcohol? Is alcohol
Schedule? No, alcohol is not.
Not a schedule.
No.
Not a schedule.
It's not in that realm because these are illegal substances, right?
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so just like nicotine is not there either.
Oh, okay.
And so because you can go and buy it in the store.
Yeah.
Once they change it to Schedule 2 or Schedule 3, then we can do research officially by the federal government to study and really be able to study, make clinical trials about the role of cannabis for medical purposes. But while that doesn't happen, it's illegal. So if
NIH
cannot give you funding. No one can give you funding.
So you could do animal work. But not clinical. No,
well, you cannot use marijuana for animals.
Oh, you could do THC or CBD.
Exactly.
I understand what you mean now.
Yeah.
What a challenge.
So THC you can buy from Sigma because it's a molecule that you can. And then you can study self-administration of THC, but marijuana, the drug.
Yeah, which is what people end up taking. Exactly. So you have to think of it as like its whole part, not its components only.
THC is the active component, of course. But until you get like cocaine, for example, but cocaine is a drug that is Schedule 2. So that's why we can study it. But if it would have been Schedule 1, we couldn't.
Wow.
For example, heroin is a Schedule 2.
Okay, that's crazy.
Hey, there you go. And you ask me, but how is it possible that marijuana is worse, which is the most dangerous.
That's really gonna, it deters research progress dramatically.
Oh, certainly. But it's all based on a fear of the moment that this law was developed on the society about marijuana. And there's a lot of issues of racism as well involved because they associated the use of marijuana with delinquents and who were the delinquents at the 1970s? And then you can imagine. So there was a lot of biases and prejudice for this drug. Mexicans, they associated Mexicans with marijuana, so therefore bad, at least in the lawmakers at the time. even they had, Nancy, they had scientists saying it's not to put it on Schedule 1. They still did it.
Yeah, well, I hope it changes soon.
I hope so too. In fact, I read in the, I think in the New York Times, there's some movement in Congress because there's so many states that already are using it. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense. But
hopefully headed in that direction. But how interesting. So your lab's trajectory, you know, I guess started in the nucleus accumbens, rewired cocaine, and now we're still in the nucleus accumbens, but, you know, more psychiatric relevant things and endocannabinoids. Mm-hmm. And hopefully in the future, you can study marijuana.
Hopefully, we'll see.
Can make progress there. That's exciting. Thank you so much for sharing your research trajectory. And we already touched on this on the challenges that you faced in the 1990s Boston. Is there another challenge that you want to share? I'm sure you have so many, but like maybe one that comes to mind now.
Okay. Well, I think I have to say that the things I have achieved as a professor, as a administrator, as a teacher, as a scientist, I've been quite fortunate to have had the opportunities. But these opportunities don't come, like the garden variety. You have to place yourself in situations where you are there for the opportunity. You have to be very strategic. And sometimes when you do that, you will confront some people in the group that may find that too much, or that you're overreaching, or that you should keep your place, or that you shouldn't think of that as an alternative, you see? Mm-hmm. And that type of undercurrent that that sometimes people say, oh, the sky's the limit. No, well, yes, the sky's the limit. But sometimes this thing about the glass ceiling, it really, there is such a thing. And for us women in science, the challenges that we faced of recognition, validation, opportunities from the standpoint in the institution that sometimes male counterparts get the opportunity before you find out that there is that available, happens. And so for me, it has been more of finding the challenge and the recognition of my, not only my peers, but the people that can have the power for you then to do more. I have decided that despite those, perhaps you would consider that a hostile environment, I've seen that, okay, what am I good at? And then I do really well. And then I don't care if other people don't think that it's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, for myself, I have achieved what I wanted. I have tried it because academia can get sometimes very difficult to navigate the politics and who is at the realm of the institution. In particular, in the University of Puerto Rico, unfortunately, our leadership changes quite often with political climate. So that has been challenging because then you change, you already achieve something with someone and all of a sudden this person is no longer there and now you have to start all over again. And that is a challenge. So that has been a challenge for me. I have been able to achieve positions of leadership like being the dean of research and graduate studies in my institution, which was something I really enjoyed very much. And then they say, well, what is your next step? You know, I'm like, well, I don't know. I think that I could do many other things. from the standpoint of the capacity that I have, the things I've learned. I mean, now I run the Office of Undergraduate Research, but I've been doing that for the last 11 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a long time. Then I now run another big institutional grant for Title V, the Department of Education, which is more focused on improving the retention of STEM students in the STEM fields in the University of Puerto Rico. I also PI and co-PI of two training grants for neuroscience at the undergraduate and graduate level. And then, of course, my lab. And I teach three of the neuroscience courses in here in Rio Piedras at the undergraduate level that everybody...
The question is, do you sleep?
I do, actually. I do. And of course, I'm a proud mom of two grown men now, but and a wonderful husband. And so, yeah, I do. But I love my work. I love what I do. I'm passionate about it. I get a little emotional, you know, sometimes when I see things not mm-hmm. happening, going my way.
Like, you're doing it.
And I'm doing it.
Like, okay,
anyway.
I'm going to do it myself. Yeah. It's not happening. I'm just going to do it myself.
So now my pet peeve lately from the standpoint of diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is now under attack in the United States, which is quite unfortunate that after all these years of hardship and struggle, people think that these things don't matter. And I think that is so, so discouraging because especially coming from a community that is part of that, no? Mm-hmm. Because being Puerto Rican in a scenario of these diverse and inclusive spaces, and a woman mm-hmm. is so important. And valuing this diversity and excellence in inclusivity is crucial for having better science, for having mm-hmm. better environments, for being really valuing what we're doing. And so now I see all these things, it don't matter. And the Supreme Court says, take it out. And I think it's a very challenging moment for science, at least in the United States, from that standpoint, because the data shows that we still have a long way to go for equity. For PhDs, we have women, if you look at statistics, women are 47% getting PhDs compared to men, which is almost 50-50. But then when you look at African-American, when you look at Latinos, we're in the 10 or less digit, 8%, 10% of PhDs rendered in the United States are from these communities. And so there is inequity already. Mm-hmm. And so I feel that now one of my pet peeves is when I go to the mainland as a representative of that community, I make sure they see me. They see what I'm there. First, they see that I'm there. Second, I speak my mind. And that has brought a lot of attention, right? And so good attention or sometimes I think it's good attention, I hope. But I remember one of these civil rights advocate that used to be Congressman Lewis, that he said, you should engage in good trouble. And I think it's true.
So you're getting in some good trouble.
Yeah, I'm getting some good trouble. And I don't mind being in good trouble because... if we don't speak, if we keep what is happening, it's just going to be detrimental for many things that we have achieved. And so I feel very strongly about that. So
that's amazing. Thanks for fighting the fight and getting in some good trouble.
I want to get into good trouble, definitely.
And to finish up, mm-hmm. Just to get to know Carmen Maldonado Blar outside of the academic institution. Uh-huh. What do you do to relax?
Oh, well, I love the beach. I enjoy much the beach, the movies. I am a movie buff. I enjoy that. And gardening. I learned to enjoy gardening recently. I grow things in my own garden. I have fruits, vegetables, and all sorts of things. I'm really excited about that. And I'm also like to do you know, trimming and growing and all this stuff I enjoy very much. And of course, having wonderful travel time with my family, which is lovely. Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Yeah, thank you, Nancy. Mm-hmm.